using non-opioid therapies and starting low and slow with dosages are among the recently released guidelines from the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board about prescribing opioids. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, August the 8th. We will talk about these new guidelines for prescribing opioids. This is an effort to combat the rise in addiction to these prescription pain relievers and the rise in heroin use. We will welcome your questions for our guest expert, and we'll welcome your own experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Michael M. Miller, the medical director of the Harrington Recovering Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. He was certified in addiction medicine by the American Board of Addiction Medicine and has practiced addiction medicine for more than 30 years. He's also a past president of both the American Society of Addiction Medicine and the Wisconsin Society of Addiction Medicine. Good morning, and thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what exactly is an opioid?
Well, an opioid is a chemical that can come from a plant, and a true opioid comes from the opium poppy. It's an alkaloid that has a variety of properties, such as killing pain, but also causing constipation and sedation and suppressing cough. And so it's been used medicinally as a plant medicine for centuries. It comes from the opium poppy. You can take the thebaine molecules, which include codeine, morphine, and heroin, that are found in the plant, and you can synthetically change them into other compounds, or you can just go to a test tube and make a molecule that has opioid-like effects or opium-like effects. So when most people think of opioids, they think of narcotic analgesics, something that will treat pain, something like codeine, morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and things given to them by a doctor. So opioid includes heroin itself, which could be a medicine but just happens to be illegal in the United States, and painkillers in a wide range, including methadone. Just a wide range of things designed to be therapeutic to relieve pain, and they do relieve pain in surgical situations and battlefield situations. So it's your pain, prescription painkillers, but a specific kind of specific prescription painkiller that is, of course, addictive.
So can you broadly tell us what these new guidelines from the state's medical examining board have to say about prescribing opioids?
Well, actually, they're a fairly strong set of guidelines. We're not the first states to develop guidelines like this, but they suggest that opioids are not the first thing to think of when somebody comes to a doctor's office and asks for pain, that they should be prescribed in different ways than has been the case for the last 25 years or so, and that physicians have responsibilities for reducing the risk that naturally comes with opioids, because we know that there's been a real epidemic in the last 25 years of overuse and misuse and addiction and overdose deaths. Certainly there's diversion of prescription opioids for non-medical uses. And these things I just described have been going up in significant trends over the last 25 years, such that a variety of professional and governmental entities have stepped in and said, wait, we need to take a relook at this. And so these guidelines actually are developed in accordance with, not because of, but in accordance with policy established by the Wisconsin Medical Society, which said that physicians should have education on how to use these painkillers beyond what they got in medical school. And that it should be mandatory as part of your licensure in the state. And the development of guidelines was supported by some of the HOPES legislation that has gotten through the Wisconsin legislature in these very polarized political times, unanimously, both houses unanimously passing these bills to provide education and prevention regarding the heroin and opioid problem in our state.
We'll go into more detail as we go along, but what was your general reaction as a practitioner, as an expert in addiction medicine? Are these is this a good move?
Well, to have them is a good move, and to provide guidance to practitioners, and of course even to up-and-coming physicians through residency and medical school is important. This particular set of guidelines is a fairly strict one. It's tighter even than any other guideline sets than I have seen. The thresholds for concern are set lower than some of the others. 50 milligram equivalents of morphine is what's listed here, whereas some states list 80, 90, 100, or 120. These are very, very tight guidelines, but they're in line with things happening around the country. And, you know, all your listeners should know that this opioid epidemic has been recognized for a while, and it was back in 2011 that the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, the Drug Czar's Office, issued its own white paper on the opioid epidemic, and one of the things it did recommend was education for practitioners and guidelines for practitioners on safer opioid prescribing.
So being that they are so strict, so strong, is there any danger here that someone who needs opioid prescription pain relief is not going to be able to get it and therefore suffer?
That possibility certainly exists. This is a reaction to a trend that was developed nationally, but spearheaded actually in our own state of Wisconsin, to get healthcare professionals more aware of pain as a real problem that patients have, and as something that needed more attention, and that there should be more of an attempt to address people's pain and not be so frightened by it. There was a time that medical boards, now understand, what we're talking about this morning is guidelines issued by the Medical Examining Board of Wisconsin, an entity established by state statute which offers licenses and then offers discipline on licenses. It can give and take away the authority to practice medicine or nursing and other professions and to deal with anybody with prescription authority. So that's a regulatory entity. But there was a time that medical boards would discipline people just for high-dose prescribing of opioids, whether they were indicated or not. And so doctors were afraid of discipline and rarely prescribed painkillers. And there was extensive data developed that even in the case of cancer pain and end-of-life care, doctors simply weren't prescribing opioids that much. And worldwide, there still is a real deficit in the use of opioids at end of life and in cancer pain situations. So actually a policy group out of the UW-Madison itself was established to improve policies with regard to opioids, and they went to all the medical examining boards, actually went to the Federation, the National Federation of State Medical Boards, and said, hey, let's loosen up some of these regs and be realistic. Let's realize that people may need pain control. So that was a good thing that happened, so that people wouldn't be deprived of pain in important situations. But what happened was, not only did that happen, but new formulations of opioids were developed by pharmaceutical companies. Very high-potency opioids came on the market that had a lot of milligrams in one tablet to provide convenience to cancer patients. They didn't have to swallow a handful of pills. This was OxyContin was the best-known one. And so there was so much more prescribing. And then doctors were given education to get them to prescribe for even non-cancer pain situations, which became a controversy in medicine. And what we ended up with was a lot of people concerned that there was over-prescribing. This is a response to over-prescribing, and we can talk about that epidemic of opioid use and overdose deaths. But the epidemic is now known to be real, and so there's a reaction. And, of course, the concern is the pendulum is swinging back too far.
Yeah, we will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue talking about these new guidelines for Wisconsin doctors for prescribing opioids. They include not prescribing these drugs as the first option to treat pain. They include using the opioids sparingly. They also, the new guidelines include telling patients that they could become addicted. And we'll talk more about opioid overprescription and the abuse problems that are trying to be combated with these new guidelines, including heroin use. We'll talk about the connection with that coming up after the news. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Dr. Michael Miller about opioid prescription guidelines, new guidelines that were recently issued to try to combat the addiction problem and the heroin use problem in this state. We are talking about these new guidelines, why they needed to be issued, and what they say. Will this help in the prescription pain reliever addiction problem? Will it help combat heroin use? What do you think? What questions do you have? Have you ever been prescribed opioids for pain management? Did you think it was too easy to get those pills or not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Michael Miller. He is the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Medical Hospital in Oconomowoc. Dr. Miller, before we go to the phones, what exactly is the connection between prescription pain relievers, such as oxycodone, and heroin, and why are they linked?
Well, the link has been talked about quite a bit in certainly my specialty, addiction medicine, but now the interesting thing is the public health community is beginning to look at it as a population problem. We've seen a vast increase in the number of opioids prescribed. Some people would use the term opioids in circulation. There's a lot of them out there. There's enough opioids prescribed in the United States for every U.S. adult to get like a significant number of pills per month. It's just, if you divide it up, it's just amazing. Commonly thrown out statistics are that well over 85% of all of the opioids in the world are prescribed in the United States, even though we have far less than 85% of the world's population. And for hydrocodone at one point, something like 97% of the world's hydrocodone was prescribed in the United States. So there's the opioids are out there, and they have historically been easy to obtain from physicians. And physicians, you know, were prescribing them in 30-unit quantities or even 90-unit quantities even for a first visit. And the statistic on it is pretty interesting. When people do have pain, the number of days they actually use pain pills is like 3 or 4. Some studies even show the total number of pills that people will take out of a pill bottle may be 5 or 6, and the rest just go to the medicine cabinet where they can be stolen. And the number one source of pills when people are using and are addicted to the pill form of opioids is not a drug dealer on the street, it's the home medicine cabinet. Well, what happens is when people develop addiction involving opioids, their tolerance goes up, they need more and more, they may have withdrawal when they stop, they have strong cravings, and their control is being placed on prescription pills, they're expensive for street value, and the street value of heroin is much less. And so people that say, I would never, ever, ever use heroin, find themselves moving to it as an alternative because, in fact, it is so available in every community in our state and our nation. Tiny towns, it's more available, actually, the statistics show, in rural areas than in urban areas. and so people transition to heroin. Very few people start with heroin. Most people with an opioid problem start with pills. Most of the pills come from legally written prescriptions that end up becoming part of the supply in general and get diverted. The other thing that's very interesting is public health authorities note that when you do have guidelines like this, one of the things that does happen is you make the supply of opioid pills tighter, and people do actually move to heroin even more for a period of time. So overall, over years, guidelines like this really help. But during the transition, this is a very sad problem that we're facing, is that the use of heroin as an alternative may actually go up. And the problem with heroin is strength and purity are unknown, and people can get a hold of a very potent batch and then overdose and die. So it's a significant problem all throughout Wisconsin. It's not a big city, and certainly not an East Coast and West Coast problem anymore.
Yeah, and one more question before we go to the phones. But the guidelines say use non-opioid therapies to treat pain, certainly at first. I mean, are there other non-opioid therapies available, or a lot?
Well, not only are there non-opioid therapies available, but the evidence on opioids as a painkiller is shockingly thin, especially for chronic pain. There's virtually no evidence that says that these improve function or even reduce symptoms for long-term use. They're really good in battlefield. They're really good in the operating room and post-op. They're good for injuries. This guideline, you know, I'm concerned at some points may be too stringent. This says there's little evidence for their use even in a short-term situation, which I don't really agree with that general statement. But plain Tylenol is as effective as opioids for many kinds of pain. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or naproxen, and of course aspirin itself is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, they are better than opioids for many kinds of pain. And the problem is doctors just being too quick with the pen or with the computer mouse to authorize a prescription for an opioid when something safer would be an option. Now, these other medicines aren't always safe. Tylenol carries some risks. Which is acetaminophen. Non-steroidals carry some risk with regard to GI issues and ulcers and such. There are risks with everything, but one of the things that's coming out now is a real look at the risks of opioids, because forever, not forever, but for, it seemed like forever, but for a decade or two, doctors were trained in continuing education programs that these were safer than NSAIDs or acetaminophen, that they didn't even carry a risk of addiction. That was false information that was actually fraudulently promoted by manufacturers of OxyContin, which is a whole side story. But yes, physicians should look at non-pill alternatives, including physical therapy, yoga, meditation, other things to deal with the pain or the problem causing the pain. And should also look to non-opioid pharmaceuticals if somebody's going to take something and put it in their mouth. And these guidelines say use opioids only as a last resort. And they also talk about documenting the results of your treatment and not continuing it unless the patient really shows clear functional improvement.
Let's go to the phones. Lynn in Geneva, Illinois, is with us. Hello, Lynn.
Hello. I have had opioids after post-surgery, double knee replacement, radical mastectomy, and a hysterectomy. And when I didn't need them any longer after I went through physical therapy, I put them in a Ziploc baggie and took them to the police department because I didn't want them in the house. And I guess that's one of the dumbest things I've ever done. I now am going to have spinal surgery on 7 vertebrae in my back, and I have stenosis in the last one. It's pushing on nerves. The nerves are shooting down my leg. It's terribly painful. I'm going to physical therapy. But that hurts so much. She said I have muscle spasms, and the nerves are all hot, and it can't heal when I'm in this kind of a situation. And I've been like this now for 6 months, and I'm really contemplating suicide. I really can't handle this pain any longer. All they've had given me is Advil, Tylenol, and ice.
and they refuse to prescribe an opioid, Linda, and you've asked?
I haven't directly asked for an opioid, but I said, isn't there something that can take the edge off this pain or help me get on top of it, even for an hour a day to be pain-free? 6 months of pain like this is, you can't think straight. I can't get in and out of a car. I can't go out to dinner. I can't do anything.
Yeah, so this might, Dr. Miller, what's your reaction to Lynn's story?
Well, Lynn, I'm very sorry to hear your story. Your story is not unique. And there are so many things that were in your story. One of them is that you've got pinched nerves from a spinal problem. That's a different kind of pain. Now, this particular guideline issued by the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board doesn't mention neuropathic pain explicitly. But neuropathic pain actually, in many studies, the majority doesn't respond well to opioids, but responds to other types of medications that nobody is offering you. Things like trade name Lyrica, trade name Neurontin. There are specific medications to treat pain that's not due to a damaged organ like a damaged joint or a damaged, an organ injured by cancer. But when you injure a nerve itself, such as pinching it, that produces injury to the nerve. That produces a different kind of pain for which you need specific medications. Now, the other thing is that you have very specific functional limitations which you can describe. And what these guidelines do is they say when you're prescribing opioids to a patient who doesn't have cancer or end-of-life issues, you should discuss about your functional targets, your aim. You should document that, ask the patient, what would you like to do if this worked, and then see if patient's function improves. And the Medical Examining Board, when looking at disciplining physicians, for a long time has looked at functional change and not just symptom relief, not just a patient saying, oh, I feel better since you gave me these meds, but that I can do more. So you should be able to do more. We would hope you would be able to do more. And you also said the biggest mistake of my life was to take my extras and bring them to the med drop. It's important that patients know about med drops and know about safe medication storage and disposal, not in your home, not just in a baggie, locked if you're going to keep it at home, but if you're not going to keep it locked at home, bring it to med drop, and there should be more med drops available. The whole issue of safe opioid storage and disposal is described in many policies on opioids and is not specifically mentioned in this MEB guideline, and I wish it had. I wish it had included more about patient education about what to do. It was not a mistake that you did, but you're regretting it because you wish you had those supplies because you are now having trouble finding a prescriber. What you need to get a prescription for is maybe something for neuropathic pain. And in your case, if you went through all of the processes of using something for neuropathic pain, using muscle relaxers to help you get through those PT sessions, and you still had pain, these guidelines still would allow the doctor to prescribe opioids, not in as high doses as before, not in as many pills as before, but to judiciously give you access to opioid supplies, measure your functional level. These guidelines should not result in physicians stopping the use of opioids altogether. And the final thing I don't want to miss, Lynn, is your comment about suicide. There is obviously a whole other topic, and Joy has had shows on the whole issue of right to die and physician-assisted suicide. So many cases of physician-assisted suicide are in patients who have major depression or who have untreated pain, where their pain was not well addressed by their health care provider, and they were so miserable that they said, I would prefer death to this. When people have pain that severe and it's not addressed, not only do we have studies showing that opioids are associated with overdose deaths, but untreated pain is associated with suicide deaths. This is a very complicated issue. It's wonderful that Joy is bringing this to our listeners today. And in your story, it's such a sad story of the things that you have faced. There are ways out of this. And the thing that also that you're lucky, it sounds like you don't have any predisposition to addiction, that you can take these without developing addiction. And one of the big fears is people developing addiction when these are used. This was the fear for years. It was probably an over-fear. The movement of the 90s and the early 21st century to prescribe opioids more said that people can't develop addiction, which is not true. It's not an either-or thing. There's a risk of addiction, but it's only in a segment of the population. And if you can take them safely, if you don't have opioid addiction in your family history or your personal history, you've taken them before and haven't developed any sort of drug liking or euphoria, to deprive you of opioids, if other things aren't working, isn't appropriate. And so we can't have the pendulum swing so far that patients like you face just a lead wall that they can't get through, where they can't find any prescriber anywhere. So thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn, for the call, and thank you, Dr. Miller, for addressing that point in particular. It sounds, Lynn, as though there is certainly hope, and I hope you'll talk to your provider about these other alternatives. We have Jim from Waukesha called in to say that he's a 50-plus-year-old construction worker with arthritis, has had a few broken bones. He lives in pain. He says, my issue with the medical system is that when I go to the doctor, I am made to feel like I am some sort of degenerate. The way the doctors are responding to people when they come in now for pain, they are not sympathetic. They think that you are lying to them just because, or think that you are just chasing drugs. I agree there needs to be regulation, but first there needs to be some compassion. So again, the pendulum may be swinging too far with this, Dr. Miller?
That's true, and the problem with the lack of compassion has to do with ignorance, and it has to do with medical training. And the thing that is so tragic, now, remember that I practice addiction medicine, right. So I'm one of the sort of rare birds out there. I'm one of the 5,000 to 10,000 at most doctors who deal with this nationally out of over 1 million physicians in the country. Medical school faculty were not trained in what addiction is, so they don't know how to teach their own students about what addiction is. And the stigma against addiction remains in our country, and unfortunately, in the general public, things have gotten better a lot faster than they've gotten within the medical community itself. Stigma against addiction is one of the things that led to what was called opiophobia back in the 70s and 80s, which is during the span of my practice, and I'm sure before that as well, where physicians were afraid of giving opioids because they were afraid of making somebody an addict, which you really can't do. You can't make somebody an addict. That's a whole other story. What is addiction? It's not about drugs. It's about brains. People with predisposition to addiction can develop addiction if you give them highly rewarding things, including opioids. So the fear of addiction led to underprescribing, but the stigma against the person with addiction permeates the medical community even in 2016. And the treating people like they're dirt, no, not like they're dirt, treating them like they're an addict, which is with a big A on their forehead, and addicts are dirt. That's the issue, is that there is stigma in the healthcare community against people with addiction, which is going to take maybe a generation to turn around. It's tragic that doctors don't know what addiction is, they don't know how to turn it around, but the hope is that medical schools will get better. The American Board of Medical Specialties just this year has established a specialty in addiction medicine. Medical school faculty will pay attention to this more and develop fellowships like we have in Madison and in, actually the only addiction medicine one is at Madison. There's not one in Milwaukee yet. So there is hope that physicians will be better trained in medical school and in a nursing school. Nurses, everybody, you're acculturated to be on guard and to treat addicts badly. And it's unfortunate, and that caller from Waukesha is speaking the truth.
We will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio once again. Then we'll continue talking with Dr. Michael Miller, who is an addiction medicine expert, about these newly released guidelines from the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board about prescribing opioids. And we're welcoming your questions and your own experiences, perhaps. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. First, this news. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the recently released guidelines from the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board that are put in place to try to combat the rise in heroin use and prescription pain addiction. Wisconsin doctors are being advised to prescribe opioids sparingly, to tell patients that they could become addicted, among other guidelines. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Michael Miller. He is the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Medical Hospital in Oconomowoc. And our next caller is Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. The problem is the use of opioids and the abuse of alcohol and people dying from that combination, people not understanding that with the high amounts of opioids and three beers can kill you. And there's no education concerning that, and people die that are not addicted, and then you have people like Lynn, who's threatening to commit suicide because she can't get opioids.
Yeah. So the I guess kind of saying is that an additional problem, or maybe a big part of this problem, is that. Patients who are prescribed opioids are also combining that with alcohol, and that makes it much worse.
Yeah, let me address that, and also for your listeners, Rogers Memorial Hospital in southeast Wisconsin is a psychiatric and addiction hospital. We're not a general medical hospital, so we don't have an emergency room, so we hope people wouldn't come when they need a general hospital. But again, thanks for having me. And your caller here raises a point. The data on alcohol, unfortunately, is not as strong. The common sense issue is obviously there, that you combining the sedative effects of alcohol with pills, and of course, every opioid pill bottle says don't take with alcohol. But the other thing is pills that work like alcohol, benzodiazepines and barbiturates. Now, barbiturates are rarely prescribed these days, but benzodiazepines like Xanax and Ativan and Klonopin are three trade names. They are prescribed. These guidelines, thankfully, do provide some mention about the co-prescribing of benzodiazepines and opioids, and they suggest that somebody on benzodiazepines really should be looked at carefully before the doctor decides to use an opioid. The other side of the equation that's not mentioned is that somebody on opioids, the doctor should think extremely carefully before ever giving them a benzo. And the co-prescribing is significant. And the data is starting to come in with regard to the fact that opioids by themselves can over-sedate you and can produce stupor, coma, and death. You can die from taking too many opioids. But the addition of benzodiazepines really increases the lethality of opioids, and that is getting better appreciated, and I'm looking forward to the day when we really do understand these risks more. So people should not use benzodiazepines and alcohol, and doctors should not co-prescribe. Now, it's very interesting, though, is that this caller just said somebody can take some alcohol, a few beers and some pills, and not be an addict and die. That is absolutely true. And one of the things that's fascinating as we use research to try to understand this problem is that prescription drug overdose deaths have a higher prevalence or rate of occurrence in the 50-year-old age group than the 20-year-old age group. 20-year-olds are dying of heroin. 20-year-olds switch from pills to heroin. But pills will kill, heroin will kill, but prescription drugs, it shockingly is in the people with chronic medical problems, people in their 50s and 60s. And so the issue of using naloxone to reduce the risk of overdose deaths, to reverse overdoses, Narcan, the opioid antagonist,
mm-hmm.
co-prescribing that to a patient on chronic pain meds has become a new trend that is now recommended by federal guidelines. And that is mentioned in here. Item 20 is the issue of using Narcan for home use. And the Wisconsin Medical Board talks about what's called partner therapy, that family members could be prescribed the Narcan, if it's not an over-the-counter drug, to be given to grandma or grandpa if they get blue in the face and stop breathing from an overdose situation. So this is a very complicated thing. It's not always what you think. Young people need Narcan to reverse overdoses from heroin, but older age groups need to have the Narcan readily available and family members instructed in how to use it to reverse overdoses that happen at home from prescription drug situations, including when people mix alcohol and benzos with opioids.
And indeed, we might have this, I don't know, stereotype of who the addict is, and it's right now it's older people, isn't it?
Well, I didn't say addiction. I said overdose deaths, and a lot of those people don't have addiction like your caller said. They have the pain
right
at home, they have the Valium, they have the alcohol, and you can have an overdose death without having addiction.
And I didn't mean to confuse the two, but let's say of those who do have an addiction.
Yeah. I mean, addiction is clearly a huge risk factor in overdose situations, but it's only one risk factor. And what physicians need to understand better, and again, there's a lot of education that's needed out there, is that there can be things done to mitigate the risks of opioid overdose other than just identifying addiction in your patients. And this guideline talks about the need to identify addiction in your patients, but there are other risk factors as well.
Let's go to John in Madison next. Hello, John.
Hi. Two questions. One, what's the range of time it takes to develop an opioid addiction? Specifically, does 1 to 2 weeks of prescribing a mild opioid run any significant risk of addiction versus, say, a chronic pain sufferer? And second, I'm wondering what the rationale is. I've heard that there's talk of, instead of using methadone maintenance for heroin addicts, they're actually thinking about having a doctor prescribe small amounts of heroin. I want to understand what the logic is here.
Well, thank you. It's a complicated set of questions. Number one, an individual who does not have their own risk factors for opioid addiction or for addiction in general, that individual may be able to take opioids for a lifetime and not develop addiction. Again, addiction is about brains. It's not about drugs. Somebody with established addiction or just with a predisposition to addiction. So many patients with addiction, remember, I'm an addiction medicine doctor, so I treat people with addiction. I see a different segment of the population, a different angle on this problem. People with addiction, sometimes they take their first opioid and develop a sense of euphoria that is so profound that they develop drug liking from the start, a strong interest in taking another dose to recreate that huge euphoria. Believe me, 90% of the public does not get that euphoria. In fact, most people get dysphoric from opioids. They may get nausea, they may get sedated, may get cloudy-headed, they just may feel emotionally lousy. So, how long does it take opioid addiction to develop? It can be very quick in somebody with a predisposition. It can be never in somebody without it. And one of the interesting questions for research is the point in between. Can you sort of give enough opioid for somebody to develop addiction? That question is an unresolved question. You can give a lab animal enough to produce something that looks like addiction, but in the complex human being, in a social world we live in, can you create addiction with a pill? I think that's not really entirely clear. The other question was heroin maintenance, which is very controversial. And maintenance therapy should be a very long-acting preparation. And I just am absolutely concerned. And I have colleagues who promote it, and people internationally are promoting the use of heroin maintenance. it's too short acting of a drug. I believe heroin maintenance, I don't think it's possible because you have to dose so often. So the idea of using heroin maintenance as a harm reduction strategy, I'm willing to debate anybody, including some of my best friends who are addiction medicine colleagues, even in Wisconsin, on this topic. Methadone maintenance is not creating addiction. It's not substituting one addiction for another. It's substituting one physical dependence. That's a whole other question. One of the things in this guideline is an encouragement of the use of specific therapies for opioid addiction, including naltrexone, which is not an opioid, it's an antagonist, but buprenorphine, trade name Suboxone, which is an opioid, and methadone, which is an opioid. Using methadone and buprenorphine to treat opioid addiction is an important treatment strategy. Using heroin to treat addiction doesn't make sense to me. Using heroin to treat acute pain, I mean, to have it be Schedule 1 is kind of interesting. It's just 1,6-diacetylmorphine. It's not some boogeyman molecule. It's very similar to morphine. Comes straight out of the opium poppy. It's illegal in the United States. But heroin maintenance is not my cup of tea.
We have a minute to go. I'm just wondering if you think these new guidelines are going to do much when it comes to opioid addiction or even heroin use.
They are. They're going to help. They're going to reduce the amount of drugs in circulation. They're going to get doctors thinking about this in different ways. They carry the risk of recreating opiophobia on the point of doctors and making it too hard for people to get opioids. There's the risk of the pendulum swinging too far. And I say that as an addiction doctor who treats addiction every day.
Yeah, and we, again, have just a little bit more time. You did mention that you thought that there could be even a spike in heroin use as these guidelines settle in.
In the transition, yes, that's been actually proven in different areas. Yep.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Michael Miller is the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at the Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc. He is certified in addiction medicine by the American Board of Addiction Medicine, by the American Board of Addiction Medicine. Thanks very much to him for joining us. Thanks to Brianne Shasso and Niaja Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. In our State Capitol report, we're going to talk about the issues that Democrats are hoping will win them some seats in the elections this fall. That's coming up in our State Capitol report. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.